When you're climbing, the Grim Reaper is never far away. He's behind a rock, smoking a cigarette. He's drinking coffee from his flask and watching you through binoculars. He's sitting, quietly and impatiently drumming his fingers on his notebook, waiting. Make no mistake, the Reaper is always there. This little account is of an experience I endured, I think you'd have to say, on a Canadian ice fall. It's got nothing to do with our friend Mr. Crowley, but it's about my life in the mountains and some of the things that I experienced. And I thought I'd produce it as a podcast, because if you're interested in mountains, if you're interested in Mr. Crowley, you might enjoy it. I don't know. Here it is, for your delight. Cheating the Reaper. So this is how it feels. Dying, I mean. It ends here. Alone, afraid. Crouching on a ledge. Struggling for breath. Vomiting quietly. A rock a meter square lands on the ledge beside me. It explodes on impact. The next one won't miss. I don't have long. Close by, a 20-meter gendarme topples slowly forward like a drunken old man and collapses. And there is the noise. The roar all around me. So loud the mountain trembles and my ribs reverberate. The rope pulls hard at my waist. A reminder that it leads down over the cliff to Steve's lifeless body. He has already stepped into the darkness. I wait at the threshold. A twig brushes my face. Just the gentlest of touches. As a tree passes overhead, hurled to its death by the monster, it reaches out to me with its fingertips. Through the fog of terror and despair that clouds my brain, a thought struggles to be heard. I'm not dead, I realize. Not yet. Somehow, I have survived the last 10 seconds. Perhaps, just maybe I can survive the next. I'd always thought that birds were dumb. Not that I'd given the matter any thought. I'm no ornithologist. One of the many things I learnt that day is that they're smarter than they look. We were descending. The hot sun had thawed the ice, making it too unstable. I relaxed. No more hard climbing today. And looked out across 1,000 snow-capped peaks of the Canadian Rockies. With mild curiosity, I looked down and noticed something in the forest 1,000 feet below. A line of birds was flying away through the treetops. There were brown ones, white ones, fat ones, thin ones, eagles, sparrows and pigeons. All were leaving the forest at the foot of the climb in a ragged line. They were leaving, I now realize. As fast as their feathers could carry them. Because they knew something I didn't. They were smarter than me. They knew that in the snow basin way above the ice climb, a pistol shot crack had split the face of another snowpack. The monster was coming. And the birds knew it. I dreamed ice in those days. Lived it, breathed it, and spent long summers waiting for the first kiss of frost to turn the glens diamond white. I moved to Scotland in search of the stuff, began my climbing in the northern corries of the Cairngorms, survived my novice years, and endured the endless weekdays, waiting for Sundays on Loch Nagar, Craigmeggie, or Ben Nevis. My days in the winter hills were technicolour. Days that live bright in the memory and sparkle amongst the grey, mundane everyday. Green Gully, Zero, Emerald, the Curtain. These were the gifts from the mountain gods. On rare, bright days, when the sunlight seemed to splinter on the ice. The disappointment of damp, black winters led Steve and me to look further afield for places where the ice god lived. Canada was the place, we decided. In Canada, it would be cold, and we would have all the ice we dreamt of. Reality and global warming conspired to disappoint, and we had caught the warmest Canadian winter for 20 years. A fact that had apparently sealed our fate. I noticed something else unusual as I watched the birds leave that sunlit Canadian day. The light was dropping. It was going dark. I remember thinking how odd that was. Curious, peculiar perhaps, but of no real concern. Catastrophe is frequently a collection of small, inconsequential errors. It was warm, way warmer than it should have been. And water was dripping from the surface of the ice as we climbed the lower pitches. We had forgotten to check the avalanche warnings. And as we climbed, our ice screws melted out. The mountain had tried to tell us, but we'd not listened. The signs were all there, but we couldn't hear them. All we could see was the shining ice that had drawn us thousands of miles from Scotland. I was watching the birds scatter when Steve called out. I turned to reply, and the mountain exploded. At moments like these, time becomes distorted, and the memory, a series of disjointed moments of panic. The monster leapt over the cliff, 100 feet above us, and landed from mid-air, bringing with him tons of wet snow, shattered ice, rocks, trees. In fact, anything that stood in his way, and we were very definitely in his way. I was just to the side of the icefall, and Steve was retreating down the climb towards me, clipping in to a back rope when the monster grabbed him and hurled him from the mountain. I watched in horror as he disappeared, and thousands of tons of rock and ice poured down onto where he had been moments ago. I knew he must be going over the cliff below us. I had to stop him. I'm not a brave man. I knew that if I logged off the belay, the shock would hit me. And if the belay failed, I'd be catapulted into oblivion. I hesitated, transfixed by fear, while the battle within me raged. Then something happened. I watched, as though from somewhere far away, as my arm swung across my body and locked off the belay. I had been on a winter climbing course to Glenmore Lodge, and they told me to use a body belay to hold a fall in a dynamic manner, to protect the belay. What they hadn't told me is what it feels like to hold a falling climber in the grip of a monster. The pain was intense as the rope tried to separate my pelvis from my chest. It cut deep into my body, cracking my ribs. But just when I thought I could hold on no longer, the rope broke, and I collapsed on the ledge, gasping and vomiting, waiting for death. I learned something else then. That when it gets really bad, surviving the whole thing feels too much. So I broke it down into small chunks, bite-sized pieces of survival. Just get through the next 10 seconds. Then worry about the rest. I pressed hard against the rock, whilst the monster hurled everything it could at me. Rocks, trees, and wet slab thundered down. The certainty of death was replaced by some glimmer of hope. I spotted a peg I'd missed before and stepped out from the meagre shelter afforded by the stands to clip into it. Anything to maximise the chances of survival. If you've seen the film Saving Private Ryan, you'll have some idea what it was like breaking cover. Remember when they land on the beach and step out into a hail of fire? That's exactly what it was like. As I clipped the peg, a rock playfully bounced off my right hand, breaking a couple of fingers, but much worse, bringing a temporary paralysis. I will never know how I wasn't killed clipping that peg. In retrospect, it was probably a mistake, but there was only one mantra going through my mind at the time. Protect the belay. As quickly as it had arrived, the monster departed, its mischief done. The sun came out and the birds returned. It was hard to believe that moments before I'd been fighting for my life. It was as though nothing had happened, apart from the fact that the ice climb we we had come up no longer existed. At the foot of the crag was a huge cone of debris, and the rope was still taut, attached to Steve's body. It seemed so utterly pointless, so stupid to have come all this way to die on a piece of ice. I knew no one could survive what Steve had endured. I knew he was dead. I didn't even shout down. There is no point in shouting at a corpse. I tied a prussic knot around the remaining rope and set off down to find the remains of my friend, dreading what I was about to meet. Just beneath a small overhang, I found him, grinning like a baboon, but alive. He had the presence of mind to roll under the overhang. He had a punctured lung and was bloodied, but alive, alive. I don't think I'll ever be more surprised or relieved. A park ranger had been one of the cars that had stopped on the highway below, was watching the spectacle. He called the helicopter, and 20 minutes later, Steve was in hospital, and I was standing on the helipad, trying to stop shaking. Every time you tie on, every time you make the first move, you take that chance. If it had ended there, would it have been worth it? The years of climbing in Scotland, seeing the starlight on the Ben. The mates, the laughs we had, the good times and the bad would have all ended there. Somehow we had cheated the Reaper. He'd had us on his list, but we had escaped him. No doubt, if he was troubled at all, I'm sure he just penciled us in for another day. So remember this. Next time you leave the comfort of the car and place yourself on a precarious rock face, if the birds leave and it goes dark, you're in trouble.